On today's episode of a DFA podcast, we talk about all the Pirates' trades, including of Cole, of McCutcheon, and of the Pirate Parrot. Don't fire your cannons. It's a DFA podcast coming your way right about now.
Welcome to episode 45 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grossnick, and joining me, as always, my co-host, RJ Anderson. RJ, what's up, man?
Not much. What about you?
I'm just trying to parse through all of the scorching hot takes about the Pittsburgh Pirates, which is something we don't get to say very often. I mean, it's usually like years and years between periods where the Pirates are worth talking about, so we'll get into that a little bit later on in the show, not too far from now, but I don't know. This has been kind of an interesting last couple of days in the transaction world, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And I'll be honest, I thought you would lead off with Adrian Gonzalez, but I'm proud of you for resisting that charm and going instead of the Pirates moves.
Oh, man, I am not so much of a Mets fan that I want to talk about Adrian Gonzalez, let me tell you that. Also joining us is our producer and co-host, Sean Brody. Sean, what's up?
Not much. I can also second you're not as much of a Mets fan to talk about Adrian Gonzalez. So
we're still going to talk about Adrian Gonzalez if we have time, but we have to cover the big deals first. And like I mentioned, that's all about the Pittsburgh Pirates. So in the span of about, I would say, 48 hours, the Pittsburgh Pirates have gone from marginal contender for a wild card spot to I'm trying to come up with a good turn of phrase for this, but the ship is sinking in Pittsburgh. Let's put it that way. The Pirates have dealt away Gerrit Cole and Andrew McCutcheon, when while Cole isn't so much of a surprise, McCutcheon has been rumored for a little while, but it still is kind of shocking to see him go. So let's go over these two trades. We've got Gerrit Cole traded to the Astros. Coming back to Pittsburgh in that deal is Colin Moran, Joe Musgrove, Michael Feliz, and outfield prospect Jason Martin. The second deal, Andrew McCutcheon is heading to San Francisco, a weird turn of events. And coming back to the Pirates in that deal is Kyle Crick and outfield prospect Brian Reynolds. So, RJ, I'm going to open this up to you first. Which of the two trades that the Pirates have made over the last few days is the one that you find the most interesting?
Interesting, you mean? Or like interesting? Because
we can use derogatory terms later. But yeah, whatever way you find them interesting, tell me about which one is the most interesting for you first, and then we'll talk about the other one.
I guess I would go with the Cole trade in the sense that it's interesting that they seem to prefer getting prospects who are either major league ready or very close to being major league ready, because, you know, when a team is trading Gerrit Cole and Andrew McCutcheon within, you know, 2 or 3 days, you don't really expect them to focus on seemingly bridging to the near future. You know, you would expect them to bring back a couple of, you know, maybe teenagers, maybe early 20 guys who are 2 or 3 years away rather than maybe 2 or 3 weeks or 2 or 3 months. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's quite the haul in terms of number of players coming back from the Astros for Gerrit Cole, but the highest rated prospect of the bunch is Colin Moran, who's almost not a prospect. He was, I believe, ninth on the list for Baseball Prospectus. He was, you know, at the very end of their top 10, and it's kind of a top-heavy top 10. Joe Musgrove is kind of, up to this point, was kind of the odd man out of the Astros rotation. They had 6 worthwhile starters coming into this before this trade, and then Musgrove was kind of like the 7th guy. And then in addition to that, there's Michael Feliz, who is a reliever of some note but not a lot of note, and Jason Martin, who's a double-A guy who probably wouldn't show up on a top 20 prospect list for this team. So you kind of hope that the Pirates would bring back a guy with kind of impact talent. I don't really see that coming back in this deal. What do you think?
No, I don't think there's any impact talent here. I talked to Christopher Crawford of Roto-World about this deal, and he said that none of these four would have ranked in his Astros top 10, and that none of the four would rank in his Pirates top 10, and that's not really what you want to hear when you're trading someone who, you know, received Cy Young votes not too long ago and has multiple years of control remaining. So, you know, we can talk about how Gerrit Cole maybe hasn't lived up to his tantalizing potential. We can talk about the odds of that happening now that he's out of Pittsburgh and what have you. But the bottom line is the Pirates didn't really get a lot of impact here. You know, Moran, there's concerns that he's not a third baseman. There's concerns that he's not going to hit enough to play in every corner position. Musgrove, who I really have to fight the temptation to call him Musgrave, seems like more of a back-end starter to me. You know, he's a big fella. Maybe he'll eat innings for you. But, you know, I don't know if he's going to ever be more than a back-of-the-end starter. Feliz, relief pitcher, you never know. But, you know, he's kind of struggled during his time in the majors. And then Martin, I don't think a lot of us were too familiar with because he's the only one of the four who has not played in the major leagues. However, even his profile seems more like decent player than really good or star-level contributor.
Yeah, as the guy who had to write up the player comments for the Astros in this year's Baseball Prospectus Annual, I have a lot of familiarity, actually, with all four of these guys, even Martin. And from my not-quite-prospecty expert perspective, this is some hot garbage for the Pirates. Martin is a guy who I really don't have a lot of faith in being at best he's going to be like a fifth outfielder type in the majors. Musgrove, he's a weird case. I think a lot of people are really excited for him to go to the Pirates and, I don't know, have some sort of crazy Ray Searage Pirate magic. But he's a guy who just pumps strikes in the zone. And while that causes him to have pretty good control, he doesn't have the world's best command to go with it. And he also gets a fair amount of strikeouts, but anytime anybody hits anything off him, it goes out of the park or for a double. And so he hasn't had great ERA and DRA numbers. Moran's kind of like, like a poor man's Wilmer Flores, almost to the point where like they both hit foul balls off their own faces last year. So that's a comp I really enjoy. And then Michael Feliz is a guy who is great at striking people out, but is also not good. Sean, I know you have a special place in your heart for Michael Feliz, so you want to talk about him for a second?
See, I would like to combat that notion. I think that Michael Feliz could turn into somebody who's a staple in the back end of the bullpen. I don't know if it'll be immediately. I'm not certainly saying that he's that right now, but like, this guy's stuff is for real. He gets some serious whiffs on that slider. He misses a lot of bats with it. He can touch upper 90s. I think he touched 100 in 2016. He dealt with some shoulder stuff last year. But the book on him has always been, can he develop a third pick? Can he develop a changeup, right? Well, there's no better place for him to go than Pittsburgh to develop that changeup. And he's always had troubles with command stuff. So, I mean, obviously you can take any pitcher and say, oh, send him to Pittsburgh and he'll do better. And if he doesn't, just blame it on the pitcher or something. But I don't think that's the case. I think that this is a good opportunity for him. I really hope they don't try to move him back into a starting role like he was in the minors pretty much with the Astros before he came up. I like Michael Feliz. He didn't have a great year last year, but he still misses a ton of bats. He's a high strikeout guy. I like him. I really, really like him. I don't think he's what makes this deal. He's definitely not worth a Gerrit Cole. But yeah, I'm very high on Michael Feliz. This guy almost struck out 100 batters in 65 innings in 2016. He's got some serious stuff.
And so, just for the record, with Michael Feliz and his amazing stuff, what was his ERA last year?
So it was 5.63. It was not very good.
Okay,
I will be honest there. Yeah.
But I'm sure his DRA was better, right?
His DRA was also 5.01. But
okay, and what was his batting average on balls in play?
His batting average on balls in play was not great. But he also stopped giving up ground ball contact and mostly just got shelled through the air. So, I mean, you could take last year, you could take 2016. He hasn't had a big enough sample to say, oh, one way or the other, I think. But
Yeah. I'm just really giving you a hard time because, you know, it's easy to do. I'm not a big Feliz guy. He's got to do one thing better, as I pointed out in the transaction analysis. He's either got to give up less walks, less hits, less homers, less fly balls. He has to do something. And if he doesn't, he's probably going to be the replacement level pitcher he was last year. But there is room for him to improve. So it could be a nice little, you know, bonus pickup for the Pirates. But if they get like a one win relief pitcher and some organizational depth for Gerrit Cole, like, that's really, really bad. It's a really bad outcome. Speaking of really bad outcomes, let's talk about the other deal. So Andrew McCutchen is going to the Giants, and coming back in that deal is Kyle Crick and Brian Reynolds. RJ, how do you feel about this deal for the Pirates?
I'm not really a fan of it either. you know, Reynolds seems mildly interesting. Crick, on the other hand, look, the guy has – you know, a long history of not being able to throw strikes. And even last year, he walked like 5 per 9. If you watch him, he doesn't know where the ball is going. I mean, it's not a situation where he can just kind of get it over the plate, or maybe he can pitch above the hands or whatever. No, he has no idea where the ball is going, and he's not able to, you know, manipulate his fastball in ways that would maximize its utility. So, you know, the idea of him becoming a late inning reliever or whatever, it's kind of a reach for me because I just don't think you can trust him in that situation. And let me just say, I think there's some cognitive dissonance about this series of trades because you see a lot of people saying, oh, well, Searidge will be able to fix Musgrove. He'll get Feliz throwing strikes. He'll be able to help Kyle Crick. Okay, but at the same time, many of those people are also saying, well, now Cole will go to Houston under Brent Strom, and he'll be able to pitch up to his upside and all. So which one is it? Is Ray Searidge capable of helping these bubble guys, these, you know, not necessarily fringe pitchers, but, you know, they're fairly fringe, but he's not capable of helping the former number one pick in the draft? I mean, are you blaming that on Cole's ego or,
you know, I think that's
entitlement, or what are we doing here? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. For Cole getting better going to Houston, there's a really easy narrative to that, and that's Gerrit Cole's best pitch is his breaking stuff, either his slider or his curveball. Every pitcher on the Astros throws more sliders and curveballs. It's a team that kind of lives off breaking balls. They also have a couple of pitchers who have developed some pretty interesting ones. You've got, you know, Lance McCullers with his curve. You've got Brad Peacock and Colin McHugh with their slider. So you could easily imagine a world where he tweaks one of those pitches or even just starts throwing it more often and Cole gets better. But I think your greater point makes a lot of sense. Like, the Ray Searidge magic bullet, it really hasn't worked out a lot for like every pitcher coming over to the Pirates. I mean, if it had, we wouldn't have these discussions about guys who do come to the Pirates and don't turn into anything special, or the guys that they develop. Let's look at Tyler Glasnow. Let's look at some of the other guys that they've had coming up in the last couple of years. It's certainly not a fait accompli that Searidge is going to just magically turn everybody into a better pitcher.
Right, and I understand the Astros narrative there, but if Searidge is the pitching coach genius he's made out to be, don't you think he's considered at some point that maybe Cole should pitch backward more often? Well, you know what I'm saying?
I would think so.
And I don't know. I just think there's a lot that goes into these kinds of analysis that, you know, we don't necessarily have a handle on, but I think we also look for very easy, simplistic resolutions to a lot of things. Like, we can sit here and say, well, maybe the Pirates will change, you know, Musgrove's arm action or blah, 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 and it'll unlock, you know, their command or whatever. But, you know, we're just spitballing here. The odds are these guys are, for the most part, what we expected them to be. You know, maybe a tweak here or there will help. But I think the other issue here is the idea that just because Searidge is a good pitching coach, and just because potentially he could fix Musgrove or Feliz or Crick, the idea that the Pirates should be playing that kind of value for these guys. Like, that the entire advantage of having a Ray Searidge or, you know, whatever factor we're talking about that can enhance a pitcher's value is the idea that you can get pitchers for less than they're worth based on the production you can get from them. So, you know, you get a Kyle Crick as a, you know, a Kyle Crick equivalent on a minor league deal. The reason he's a bargain for you is because you're able to get more performance out of him than other teams could at the same price. If you're valuing these guys with that bump already in mind, you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot. And this is my point. This is the point I made before about framing runs, too. If you're paying market value for framing runs, you're messing up because you can get these kinds of projects, you know, anywhere. You know, like Kyle Crick, like, We talked about his fastball, or we didn't talk about his fastball. We kind of talked about his stuff profile. He's basically a fastball guy. You know, the breaking stuff isn't really consistent. You'll see him hang and bang them all the time. You can find that exact profile as a minor league free agent. It's not like he's got special velocity in this day and age. It's not like he has crazy movement or anything like that. He is a, you know, broad-shouldered, wide-hip guy. He looks like a starting pitcher still, but that doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot at this point in his career. So, I don't know. I'm not going to sit here and place, you know, special value on a guy like Kyle Crick, because you can find that profile on basically, you know, the waiver wire, on the minor league free agent pile. It's not special anymore. So, I can't value this guy highly because I don't believe he's going to take a huge step forward. I think he's basically what he is, and, you know, that's fine to roster, I guess, but it's nothing special, and it's really disappointing that that's the entire return for McCutchen.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about what it means for the Pirates to deal away their number one overall pick from a few years back, and I would say probably the most charismatic, recognizable, and best player for the Padres since, or for the Pirates since, I don't know, maybe since Barry Bonds left town, in Andrew McCutchen. And, you know, the Pirates, I think their management said something along the lines of, we will continue to make difficult and unpopular decisions this offseason. And, like, boy, did they ever. Like, this is some stuff that really kind of crushes a fan base. The Pirates are now tearing it down. They're going to go into some sort of rebuilding mode. And the outlook for that is not super bright. There's a couple of years of, you know, toiling away at 60 wins or 70 wins or something like that. And, you know, the all that they were able to kind of peek at up to this point were a couple of wild card games. Not exactly what you're hoping for when you've got a mid-market team like this. And I tend to think that if you're going to trade away Andrew McCutchen for players like Kyle Crick and Brian Reynolds, don't trade away Andrew McCutchen.
Yeah.
So I think that this is definitely kind of driven by this idea of, we have to save some money and we have to get something back for McCutchen, rather than looking at the benefits of having, well, you know, he could be a 3-win outfielder, he could be a 4-win outfielder, but also he's going to do quite a lot for the fan base. It'll do right by, you know, the people who are out there buying season tickets, as opposed to, we're going to trade him away for what appears to be pennies on the dollar and piss everybody off.
Right, and are you telling me that they wouldn't have gotten a similar deal come July if they had just held on to him, maybe took their chances with the roster they have in place? And
I mean, you know, it's always possible he could have gotten injured, but yeah, I think you would definitely get this much in July.
Yeah, and if he gets injured, you could probably still get a draft pick back, right, at the end of the year?
Yeah, that's right.
So I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking here. And I would also say some of their moves – I mean, they just went out and acquired Sean Rodriguez late last year, and they're paying him, you know, decent money for a bench player. Well, why do that if you're just going to do this? And, you know, why – there's just a lot of questions I have about this whole thing. And, of course, they did make one move that's sure to be popular by re-signing Felipe Rivero to a very team-friendly contract that gives them control over his first two free agent years and locks in his arbitration value. He was a Super 2 player, so you're talking about 4 years of arbitration there for – a closer, and frankly, one of the better left-handed relievers in the game. So, you know, that's a smart move on their part. Of course, the funny thing is, you know, while that news was breaking, Rivero was on Twitter reacting, let's say stunned, in a stunned sense, to the McCutchen trade. He posted the facepalm emoji, which is never something you want a player who you just committed $22 million to post. And he also posted a GIF from The Office that asked, what is going on here? So Felipe Rivero probably not regretting being guaranteed $22 million, excuse me, but maybe a little skeptical of the direction the Pirates are going and might be thinking about when his exit will be coming in the next few years via trade.
Yeah, I think this is kind of an interesting deal. Just to clarify what you said before, he had 4 years left in arbitration. This deal buys out all 4 years of those arbitration. Then there's some options for the post-arb years. So it doesn't add any service time unless the Pirates go all in on those options. It's a reasonable value. Now they can run him out there on closer and not worry about getting arb raises from saves because he's good. I almost think that this deal makes him more likely to be traded because it kind of cements some value. It makes him like a more reasonable cost guy. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Pirates, you know, run him out there this year and then trade him next offseason and get a lot back for him. Because what good is Felipe Rivero on this team the way they're currently constructed or in the next year or two? You know, if you're going to sell off McCutchen and Cole, why really go ahead and try to make a long-term commitment to a relief pitcher, which are notably, you know, kind of volatile? You have to have one, but I think this is more of a deal where they just want to get some cost certainty and he'll eventually be off this team too.
I agree with that. I will note that Jerry Prasnick tweeted over the weekend that the Pirates' internal metrics did not really change with the Cole trade, which is pretty interesting to me, and I wonder if they view the same thing of the McCutchen trade, and maybe they're really high on Austin Meadows' ability to stay healthy, and they think that he'll come up in June or July and slot into that outfield, and this team will be just as good as it was before. And I don't know what to think about that because I don't really agree with that line of thinking. However, maybe they're more optimistic about their chances than most anyone else is, and I don't know. Maybe they think this team can still compete for a wild card. I certainly don't think that's likely. But with, you know, the idea that the Cole trade not changing your internal metrics by much at all is really surprising to me.
Yeah, I kind of am in the same boat. Craig Edwards of Fangraphs said something like that yesterday on Twitter, that the team's going to be just about as good as they were despite these moves. Obviously, I don't agree. But even if you argue that they are going to be as good next year, they don't have Andrew McCutchen. And they've sincerely pissed off their fan base. And the Giants have done this for two teams now, where they have acquired a face of the franchise who maybe was becoming available due to financial reasons, and they've kind of come in and picked up these veterans. So I want to talk about this a little bit from their perspective, because I find it really interesting that they've gotten these guys who have had some down years in the past couple of years, but they're veterans, they're formerly elite players, and they're using this way to round out their roster rather than go out and buy J.D. Martinez or buy Mike Moustakas to play third base. I really kind of find this interesting, and I actually am really fond of this deal for the Giants, and when combined with their Longoria one. Yeah, it's adding a lot of money, but it's not as much money as it might have been to go out and sign J.D. Martinez. And when you have elite players like these, or at least formerly elite players, sometimes they still play at elite levels. So I think that if the Giants were really looking to compete in the National League West this year, this isn't a bad way to do it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And they basically took advantage of both Pittsburgh and Tampa Bay. I mean, Tampa Bay, everyone talks about the money they saved, but when you look at it, they really saved what, like, I think it was like $80 million over 5 years or $70 million. Like, they took back Denard Span's contract and pitched in money, I believe. And, you know, what's that going to get Tampa Bay on the free agent market? You know what I mean? Like, there's not really that much money saved there. And there is I think there has to be value to having a guy like McCutchen around, even if you're not necessarily competing, because of the franchise player aspect. I think we've maybe went too far away from the emotional aspect. We're too cold and too logical nowadays with this stuff, and we've kind of forgotten what it's like to be a fan, and especially if you're a younger fan. I don't know. But to the Giants' point, yes, I do think there's a lot of value in their approach as opposed to, you know, going out there and throwing money at whatever moves. They're very near that luxury tax number already, so It seems like they are – upgrading the roster in areas they need to upgrade while also perhaps maintaining some flexibility for next year if you consider the luxury tax number like a hard cap for them, which it probably shouldn't be, because, you know, if any team could, you know, take advantage of this slow free agent market and go out there and get Lorenzo Cain or really any of the center fielders out there, you know, move McCutchen to a corner. Honestly, you could have made the case that the Giants needed three new outfielders entering this winter, because Hunter Pence was horrible last year. Denard Span obviously is no longer there, and left field has just been a mess for them for a while now. So, yeah, I think they should go out there and sign one of the center fielders and, you know, then take a look at that roster, because I don't think they were actually as bad as they were last year. I think if they were just rolled with the same roster, they would have probably gotten better results. But it's possible I'm just too optimistic about their core, you know, Belt figuring it out and Crawford learning how to hit again and so on and so forth. I don't think they're as good as the Dodgers, obviously. I don't know if they're going to be a realistic contender within the division. It might come down to a wild card spot, and obviously they're going to have some competition for that. But I do appreciate that the Giants are not hitting the reset button, you know, not taking the easy way out here and actually trying to make an effort to win games, because that's what's supposed to be the goal for everyone. It's not supposed to be looking smart. It's not supposed to be saving money. It's supposed to be winning games, and right. You know, you have to give the Giants credit for that.
So we'll just throw out a quick question to both you guys. Sean, I'll let you start. Is the National League West the best division in baseball for 2018?
Maybe. Because the only other division you could probably argue is that the AL East will just be a top-heavy battle between the Red Sox and Yankees. And so, like, I mean, well, let me rephrase that. Yes, the NL West is the best division, top down.
But... Way to go! Way to shift to the hot take. I love that.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think you could have the AL West even like working up a little bit. The A's aren't going to be there, but the Angels are better. The Mariners are still kind of there. I'm assuming Texas is going to make more moves towards the end of the offseason. But yeah, probably the NL West.
Yeah, I would say it's one of the West, because you know the Central's. The National League Central has, what, three teams who could realistically compete at this point, with the Reds on the rise. The National League East is a mess. The American League East, like Sean said, is pretty top-heavy, and the American League Central is not good. Yeah, I would go with – I guess you have to go with the National League West at this point, because the Padres are the only quote-unquote weak team in the entire division, and we all know, you know, they have our good friend Kyle McGrath, so who knows?
I'm just checking my notes here, and the correct answer is the National League West is the best is the best division in the game. I really, when I think about it, the only other team that I can comfortably say would be close to the same level of excellence would be the National League Central, between the Brewers and the Cardinals and the Cubs. But they have two teams that are kind of lower level. Yeah, the Reds are getting better, but the Pirates are not. So I think that's definitely that. But, you know, you have three playoff teams from last year in the National League West. Each of those teams has gotten better, with the exception of maybe the Dodgers, but the Dodgers already won like 100 games last year. And then now you've got the Giants on the rise. The Padres are garbage, and that will continue, you know, probably forever, but that's fine. I just can't see any other division that's even close. So yeah, for me, it's going to be the National League West, which could actually hurt some of these teams' chances with all the interdivision games. Maybe you'll only see one wildcard team come out of the West this year, because, I don't know, some team like the Cardinals or the Brewers might be able to scavenge some wins by playing against some cruddy teams in their divisions. So that covers most everything for the Pirates, as much as we can. Let's take a couple of batting practice topics, because, you know, kind of strangely, there have been some other marginally interesting moves this last week. We actually have some stuff going on, even though the hot stove is still, you know, on low. It certainly hasn't heated all the way up.
Yeah, the first one we lead off with is Addison Reed signing with the Twins, 2 years, $16.75 million guaranteed. It seems kind of light for Addison Reed, the first take there. The second take is probably Fernando Rodney's back in the same exact mold he was in Arizona, right?
Yeah, I mean, and this – go ahead, Sean. I mean, Brian.
I was just going to say $17 million for Addison Reed is about $250,000 less than what the Mariners paid for Juan Nicasio, and that's crazy. That doesn't make any sense to me.
And this is the third bullpen addition of the winter, joining Rodney and Zach Duke. So this has been a priority for them. And, Brian, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Go ahead and name the Minnesota Twins rotation as it stands today.
Barrios?
Yep.
Barrios?
Irvin Santana.
Yeah, obviously Irvin Santana. Phil Hughes is probably not coming back, so you got to write him off.
Kyle Gibson.
I'm sorry?
Mejia.
Yeah, Adalberto Mejia. And then I would imagine Gonsalves is going to come in as the fifth starter at this point, but
Aaron Seagulls is the guy that They need to add a starter, but I will also note they have Trevor May coming back in the bullpen. He underwent Tommy John surgery last March. It'll be a second-half return for him. Can help that bullpen. Obviously, they have some interesting guys who we haven't named, but yeah, I like it for Minnesota. I like that they're trying to win, which is something we're not saying about a ton of teams right now. And it wouldn't surprise me if Reed actually ends the season as their closer. I love Fernando Rodney, but you know the clock's going to strike midnight at some point for him, and it could be this year.
I was just going to bring up, Sean, your dude, Trevor Hildenberger, is at the end of that bullpen. He's another guy who I really like as a reliever for this team. So now they look like they could compete if they go out and get that other starter. I don't think that's any question. With the market being down and stuff, the Minnesota Twins really should just throw all the money at Yu Darvish. Do we have any arguments against that? Like, that's what they should do? Or is there something else that anybody thinks they could do better than
that? Oh, no, that's absolutely what should be done. And, yeah, Brian, I do like your tag back to the bullpen. Is there's more interesting guys there. Yeah, Hildenberger. But
I mean, it's so easy to keep Sean happy on this show. You mentioned Trevor Hildenberger. You mentioned, you know, Jared Hoyer. And we've got him. But, we've got him.
Yeah, Yu Darvish is obviously the big get. I don't know if Darvish will actually want to go there, because the thought with Reed was that he wanted to go back to the Central or to Central America or whatever, and like that's why he took less money to go to the Twins. Don't know how true that is, but like
I'd have to
think that Yu Darvish would have to be absolutely blown away, and the Twins would have to be like what, $3 million more per year on average away from the next best guy for them to actually get him.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that's completely, you know, out of the – just in the realm of speculation. But it sounds like he's at least one of the five or so teams that he's considering at this point. So not outside the realm of possibility. But if they can't get Darvish, they should go get a Lance Lynn. They should go get an Alex Cobb. They should get somebody else in that second tier of starting pitchers, because that's the team's weakness. And they are a legitimate wild card contender at this point. They got to go for it.
I'm a bit surprised they couldn't beat the price for Gerrit Cole, too. Certainly they have a deep system.
Well, anybody could have beaten the price for Gerrit Cole. I don't think that's not the argument. You know, maybe the Pirates, their pref lists, their guys, their analytics staff or their ops staff really like Joe Musgrove. And so to us on the outside, it looks like, well, you know, any team could have beaten that. But really, they would rather have Musgrove than Steven Matz or Zach Wheeler or, you know, Gonsalves or Mejia from the Twins, or, you know, lots of these other teams. So we don't know what their pref lists look like. At the same time, like, there is no question that if I were in the Pirates, perspective, I'd be like, hey, Max Kepler and, Gonsalves or Mejia or somebody like that, and, you know, two AA guys. And I would prefer that deal as the return for Gerrit Cole than somebody else, but I don't get to make those kind of decisions.
All right, so for good with talking about the Twins, which is a weird thing to say on this podcast, we'll go now to Brad Hand, signing an extension with the San Diego Padres, 3 years, $19.75 million guaranteed, with a $10 million option in year four with a $1 million buyout. So, got to hand it to him?
Oh, my God. This is basically the Felipe Rivera deal all over again. You could say that it boosts his trade value and then he'll get moved in July or next winter. But it's a good deal for the Padres. You know, they're going to save money, blah, 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 blah. Let's move on to the next one, unless you have something to add about that, Brian.
Yeah, the only thing here is that, you know, the Padres aren't going to be good soon. So Brad Hand is not going to be a Padre soon. Cost certainty, sure. We can move on.
Moving on now, much more interesting player here. Howie Kendrick re-signing with the Nats, 2 years, $7 million. Probably going to be a bench bat. Don't know that he's going to have a starting rotation. But, I mean, $7 million for Howie Kendrick over 2 years?
Yeah, I like that. Mm-hmm. I like it a lot.
There's nothing not to like about this. The Nationals have a really good bench, don't they?
Yes, they did. They got Matt Adams for less than they would have paid Adam Lynn. They have Brian Goodwin sitting around. He looked pretty useful last year. You know, Defoe, supposedly their second baseman of the future. Who knows if that'll come to fruition. But, you know, they really could go out there and get a catcher. I know it's going to be hard to do that. But if they could, that would be a nice boost to them. And that would really make this I guess we say this every year about the Nationals, though. This is a really nice-looking roster. There's like one little area of weakness, maybe two. And then, you know, we enter the year, we start talking about that area of weakness nonstop. They address it, and then they get hit with the injury bug in August and September and end up losing a heartbreaking division series. So I like this roster on paper, and this is just a nice little piece of depth signing, and, yeah, I like it a lot.
Yeah, the one thing I'll say about the Nationals is this whole thing with now Victor Robles taking on what I would imagine is an everyday job in the outfield, Trey Turner hopefully going to be the everyday shortstop. So we're looking at more or less the, you know, Eaton, Harper, and Robles as the outfield in Washington. They kind of have a chance to be the second best outfield in baseball now, don't they?
Yeah,
especially if you look at the depth pieces like Kendrick behind them.
Yeah, they have a lot of depth behind them with Goodwin and even Michael Taylor. I mean, Michael Taylor could conceivably start on a few teams.
He's useful.
Yeah, he's fine. You know, if you enter the season with him and you're trying to, you know, screw over Robles, you wouldn't get an argument from a lot of people because, you know, that's the smart thing to do, supposedly. So, yeah, this is a good roster. I mean, you know, Mike Rizzo gets joked on because, you know, the managerial situation and, yeah, I don't know. This is a good roster. It's a good front office. And, I mean, they're going to win the National League East. Like, there's no doubt in anyone's mind about that, right? Like, who's threatening them?
No one. I think it's going to be great to watch them get bounced in Game 5 of the NLDS again. It's going to be magical. Get them, you know, beaten half to death by, like, you know, the Cubs or something. But I do think they're actually stand a really good chance of being the number one seed out of the National League, which will be a nice change of pace for them, I hope.
Yeah, because they're going to devour the other National League East teams. You know, the Braves. Oh, yeah. I know the Phillies have gotten a little bit better, but yeah, they're still not good.
So I know it's just a 2-year deal, but do you think that Howie Kendrick finishes off this deal with the Nationals? And that's seems like an easy answer, but at the same time, there's no guarantee what's going on next year with them. So do you think he finishes off the deal with them?
Yeah, because if they lose Harper, they can slot Kendrick into a corner outfield spot if they really wanted to.
Yeah, and there's no reason for them to move on from him unless they completely fall apart, because he's so reasonable. He's a professional. He's a veteran. He's going to be a good clubhouse guy, because he kind of always has. And plus, you know, the fact that he can play some infield is, you know, that's not the best spot for him at this point. But no team really wants to give up a player with that kind of versatility. I was kind of shocked that he got the deal that he did to take a bench role somewhere. I thought, you know, somebody like Kansas City could bring him in to start. And so that's why I was kind of shocked to see that.
Maybe he wants a ring. You know, he wants to be on a good team, and he got a taste for it the last few years between the Dodgers and the Nationals, and he decided, I'll take less money. I'm nearing the end of my career. I've made, you know, made like $20 million in the last 2 years, so money's not necessarily the biggest object to him at this point in his career, I would assume. And
yeah,
why not? Plus, you know, I hear it's nice in D.C. So
I know. That's the word that we get from you, RJ, so – sounds about right. All right, anything else that we've got to look at, Sean?
Well, we've reached the Curtis Granderson portion of the offseason, apparently. 1 year, $5 million to the Blue Jays, and did you think he was going to end up playing this year, or did you think he was going to retire?
I kind of thought he was going to play. I think this might be the first overpay of the offseason. I love Curtis Granderson. I think he's a great guy in the clubhouse, great guy in the community, and a pretty decent player. But he looked toast last year with the Dodgers. And $5 million for a year, I really thought he was going to get something like $2 or $3 million or maybe even an NRI minor league deal coming off just how bad he was at the end of last season. For the Blue Jays to commit $5 million to him, I know it's not a lot of money, but it's kind of a lot of money for a player like him, especially when he's like a strict platoon guy. He's only a corner guy. And the Blue Jays have a ton of outfield depth. They've got Dalton Pompey waiting. They've got Anthony Alford waiting. They've got Teoscar Hernandez in the mix. So I was kind of surprised by this deal. I don't hate it, but I do see it as a little bit of an overpay, and it could very well be one of those moves where he's really just there to provide the clubhouse presence and be a positive influence on the rest of the team, which there's a lot of value in, but I don't really see a lot of value left in him as an everyday player for sure.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I guess the thing is, you know, he's not going to sign for an NRA at this point in his career, is he? He's going to be 37. You know, if you offer him a non-roster invite, he's probably just going to go home and, you know, pack his bags and whatever. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I agree with all that. And I think there is one other move that we sort of hinted at earlier, didn't really address, and that is Mr. Adrian Gonzalez signing with the Mets. So go ahead. If you want, you know, you can just give word association on your thoughts of that deal. Brody, you can lead us off here.
Okay, so last part on Curtis Granderson for me is just it's kind of surprising that he got more than Howie Kendrick did. Kendrick was 3.5 per year. Granderson was 5 for 1 year. That's a little surprising. But in terms of Adrian Gonzalez, Jay Bruce and Adrian Gonzalez or Jay Bruce and Howie Kendrick is something that I don't understand how they got wrong.
Well, so Adrian Gonzalez is a lot less of a commitment than Howie Kendrick. And going back to if Kendrick wants to play for a contender, guess what? Don't play for the Mets. That's a terrible idea. But I'm going to take the opposite side of most people on the Mets issue, and I'm going to say I like the Adrian Gonzalez signing for the Mets. It's a complete vote of no confidence in Dominic Smith. It is basically the Mets, to me, saying Dominic Smith is not our guy at first base. And that's fine with me because I don't think Dominic Smith's the guy at first base for the Mets. Gonzalez, if he's more healthy, is probably going to be a better player in 2018 than Dominic Smith, even if he only plays a little bit. I mean, he still has better hit tool than Dominic Smith. He's still got more power than Dominic Smith. He's definitely going to reach base more. He may not be healthy, but I definitely think he's an okay signing for this team, especially for the league minimum. Now, the Mets roster is a kind of a trash fire because of the way that they keep bringing in left-handed bats, and you kind of think Jay Bruce is going to be the first baseman when Michael Conforto comes back. There's a lot of moving parts here, and the Mets aren't really equipped to deal with it. But in a vacuum, Adrian Gonzalez on a small contract to play first base, and of course he's probably going to have back issues next year, which that's fine. But I don't see a problem with this. I see a problem with the way the Mets do pretty much everything else, though.
I'm not big on bringing in another first baseman, just like you said. And I think that if they are really low on Dominic Smith, first of all, there's no guarantee it goes in the future. But if you're that low on Dominic Smith and you're to the point where you want some kind of replacement for him, or you think Jay Bruce is first base long term, doesn't signing Adrian Gonzalez and that kind of flow of thought kill some trade value for Dominic Smith?
No.
If you wanted to actually move him?
No, I don't buy that, because I think if you want to up Dominic Smith's trade value, the best way to do it is not to have him hit .250, an empty .250 in New York. It's to have him hit a empty .350 in Las Vegas during the team's last year in that park. At the same time, I don't think anybody's super high on Dominic Smith. I don't think a 2018 surge in AAA or falling apart in the majors next year is going to change his trade value very much. These guys are who we think they are at this point. And I don't think, a dramatic amount of playing time. The playing time in the major leagues might improve Dom Smith's skills. The seeing more major league pitching might actually help him develop a little bit. I don't think he has anything to prove in AAA. I just I think that trade value wise, he's going to pull whatever he pulls based on his track record and his skill set, and everybody kind of already knows it.
Which I can kind of understand. Dominic Smith to me is like the Mets version of Jurich and Profar for the Rangers, to where each fan base thinks they have a lot more trade value than they actually do. I agree with that. I just wanted to see if you could chase a rabbit or something.
This is where we have to end the Mets talk, because we have a new rule on here. If we go past 3 minutes on a non-important Mets deal, we have to call the show. So
RJ has implemented this rule over and over again. It's not really helping very much.
It's called the sanity rule.
So thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the DFA podcast. We'll try to get back to you if the Pirates decide to, sell off another major part of their team. Not that there are very many left. But in the meantime, you can catch up with us on Twitter at DFA podcast. You can email us at DFApodcast@baseballprospectus.com. You can read RJ and all of his fantastic work at CBS Sports. You can read mine at Baseball Prospectus. And you can imagine what Sean is writing about, in your own head. But on behalf of RJ and Sean, I'd like to thank you for listening, and we'll see you guys next time.